In November 1918, Germany emerged from defeat in the First World War as one of Europe's new republics. To some Germans, this was the fulfilment of a dream of equality and democracy. To others, it was a nightmare of shame and national humiliation. In 1945, Germany lay in ruins, defeated for a second time, having unleashed war and genocide across Europe. To help us understand what happened in Germany in the years between 1918 and 1945, I'm joined by Robin McPherson and Matthew Patty from the Wellington College History Department. Robin, could you set the scene of Germany at the time of the armistice in November 1918?
Yes, good place to start, because November 1918 brings to an end the First World War, and it's a war that the Germans tried very, very hard to win in 1918. And this is why we get so much political confusion, I think, going into 1919 and also the Treaty of Versailles. When the war is over, it's because the Germans have actually asked for peace terms from the Americans. The American condition was that the Kaiser had to step down and they wanted a newly democratically elected government in place and they wouldn't negotiate with anybody else. So for the Germans, this seemed fairly obvious because what the Americans were proposing was a very fair peace. It would be a peace without serious punishment, and in the future, the stability of the world would be guaranteed by a League of Nations. So for the Germans, this looked like a very good deal and one that they could walk away with without really too much disgrace from the end of the war. Unfortunately for a lot of the German soldiers in 1918 when they head home, they feel betrayed because the German army is still actually in France. And the one thing they know they don't like is the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, because they don't like left-wing politics. So when they get back to Germany in late 1918, what they discover is an awful lot of Germans in the home front were influenced by the Bolshevik Revolution. Those people are now trying to actively seize power. So it sets the scene for what is a sort of small-scale civil war, I suppose you could call, where we have a newly democratically elected government, as per the American request, waiting to find out what the peace terms are going to be from the Allies, trying to establish control. But this is a Germany that's really falling to pieces economically, in a state of serious discord, and into 1919 that's only going to cause more problems.
This was clearly a very difficult time for this fledgling new government. As you've said, it's a new republic in which adults can vote, with a new proportional voting system, new political parties and an elected president. Matthew Paddy, can you tell us why many Germans on both the right and the left were opposed to this new system?
Well, it seems funny, doesn't it? It sounds like a very good new system of government. Basically, a liberal democracy is formed, as Robin says, at the request of the Americans. On the right, essentially, what we get is a lot of very disaffected, very angry nationalists. A lot of them are ex-soldiers who feel they've been betrayed by their government. They are actually supporters of the Kaiser, supporters of a traditional strong Germany, and they view that their traditional way of life has been taken away from them. So there's a group of on the right who are very hardline from that respect. Similarly, on the left, there's a rising, as there always is in a period of political turmoil, of the far left as well as the far right. And so we get a group like the Spartacists, led by Rosa Luxemburg, who want to see in Germany not a democracy, but they view this as the prime opportunity to spread communism within Germany, similar to the revolution which happened in Russia in 1917. They want to see a similar thing happen here. So they also view this as an unsatisfactory outcome to have a democracy. They want to see equality spread throughout Germany. Versus this group on the right, as I say, who want to basically go back to the Kaiser, to a strong nationalist Germany.
Robin, a moment ago you mentioned the expectations of many Germans that the peace settlement would follow the plan outlined by Woodrow Wilson. What peace settlement did Germany actually get, and why does it remain so controversial to this day?
I think the problem was, for the Germans, it came as a massive surprise. The war ended in November 1918 with an armistice, but an armistice is really meant to be a ceasefire that all sides lay down their weapons so they can talk peace terms, and if those peace terms don't work, then war can start again. But this was an armistice with a difference, because the French insisted that the Germans withdraw from France and they'd leave behind all of their heavy equipment. So if the peace discussions didn't go well for the Germans, they had no option but to accept the outcome, because they couldn't start fighting again. So they're in a very weak position. The second problem that hits them is that when the Allies get together in Paris, Woodrow Wilson's fair peace is obviously challenged by the French and the British, who have lost far more men and their economy has been seriously damaged by the war. So they never agreed to the 14 points, so they weigh in with demands that they have. It takes so long to thrash these demands out that the plan had been to give them to the Germans to then discuss them point by point to see if they could negotiate. Instead, in May 1919, the Germans are issued this peace treaty as an ultimatum and said, you have to sign this or else. And at this point, the German government is shocked. It doesn't look anything like the 14 points that they'd initially signed up for. In fact, the government resigns en masse in protest at it. That doesn't hold any sway with the Allies. They turn around and say, well, tough, either you sign this or we will see you in Berlin with our armies. So a month after, in June the 28th, 1919, the Germans have to sign the treaty. And what it does is it systematically disables the country. It rips out its military. They're only allowed 100,000 soldiers, which is a really tiny force compared to the traditional size of the German army. They're not allowed any new technology, so they're not allowed any submarines, they're not allowed any tanks, they're not allowed any planes. Their navy, which had been substantial, isn't allowed to have anything after the dreadnought was released, so it's all old battleships and very limited in number. So it means that Germany's going to be very weak. But actually the part of the treaty that the French thought was their best security for long-term safety was demilitarising the Rhineland, which meant that in the event of a future war, unlike the First World War, the French would march onto German soil straight away rather than the Germans marching through Belgium into France. So very much an open door on Germany's western frontier. Besides that, lots of land losses, German colonies stripped away, and they were also punished for wars that went back before the First World War. So they lost territory to Denmark, which they'd got in the 19th century, and they were told they weren't allowed to have an alliance with the Austrians. So a whole list of land losses that aggravate German nationalists. And the new creation of Poland, a country that disappeared from the European map in the late 18th century, comes back. And to give the Poles a city in the sea, they're given Danzig, which was a major German port. This would be a bit like giving Portsmouth to the French, just for fun. And the Polish corridor also cuts off East Prussia from the rest of Germany. So any German looking at the map of Germany in 1919 would look at something that they consider to be horribly mutilated. Adding to this, huge economic impositions, the Germans have to agree to pay damages for the war. That total isn't set for a couple of years yet, so basically they've agreed to pay an open-ended commitment to damages to the Allies. But the thing that probably angers nationalists the most is a point of principle. They're accused of starting the war deliberately. So this follows in Article 231, the War Guilt Clause, probably the most infamous part of the whole treaty, in which the Germans have to say, yes, we started the war in 1914, it was our fault. They vehemently deny this because the Russians mobilised before they did. And historians have been throwing this one around ever since. But it does mean that across the board, the Treaty of Versailles really hammers Germany. And it's unexpected for the democratic government, but it's a massive insult for anybody who's a German nationalist.
This is clearly a treaty that is received very bitterly in Germany. Matthew, could you tell us a little bit about the political reactions inside Germany and some of the instability that follows in the 2 or 3 years after 1919?
Yeah, so essentially this political divide, which begins with this creation of a republic, of a liberal democracy, gets significantly worse. The one thing that both the left and the right can unite on is that war guilt clause. The reaction from the left, again, is attempts to incite communist revolution. As I said, the Spartacist uprising is the earliest example we have of an attempted coup on the Weimar government, this fledgling government. Which is put down, the strength or lack of strength of the Weimar government is actually revealed in the fact that to deal with the Spartacists, they call in the right-wing opposition, who are a group known as the Freikorps, largely disaffected, angry ex-German soldiers from World War I. So what we have is a situation whereby a government is too weak to actually control the opposition themselves, so they have to rely on the right-wing opposition to put down the left-wing. Then, of course, the right wing have their attempt. We have something called the Capped Putsch, putsch meaning sort of rebellion or uprising, led by the right wing this time. The year in which it all really sort of starts to really kick off is in 1923, though. Robin mentioned the reparations which are put on Germany. The figure that is eventually fixed upon is £6.6 billion. And what happens is that very, very quickly, as we said, Germany's economy has been... the heart of it's been torn out, so they're not able to produce that cash. And they fall behind in 1923 for the first time on reparations. As a reaction to this, the French are not particularly pleased. And what they decide to do is, well, if you can't pay us in cash our reparations, we're going to take this in terms of material resources. And so what they do is they march into the Rhineland and they march into the Saarland, and they try and take this back in terms of natural resources. The reaction from the German government initially is one of passive resistance. However, this sort of largely fails. And what we then get is a truly remarkable policy, which is... as we don't have cash to pay the French to get them out of our land, what we'll do is print it instead. So what we see is the German government produce excess cash, which even with a very basic sense of economics, you can understand what happens is it devalues the currency and inflation skyrockets. We get sort of ludicrous situations then, whereby the cash value of money is almost non-existent. We get people going to buy a loaf of bread with a wheelbarrow full of cash. We get accounts of people who say that the money was so worthless, rather than buying coal with it because they couldn't afford it, they'd simply burn piles of money to do that. And 23 again, we see another rebellion in terms of political instability. This time led by the right again. It's led in Munich, not the capital of Berlin, led in Munich by Hitler and his newly sort of, I say founded, sort of altered Nazi party, the National Socialists, in 1923, the Munich or Bierhofputsch, which fails in terms of its objective to try and take power from the Weimar government, but it does gain a lot of support for the Nazi party.
Robin, could you just tell us a little bit about the origins of Adolf Hitler in German politics and how he emerged as a leading radical in southern Germany in the early 20s?
Yes, can do. Hitler is one of a huge number of ex-soldiers coming home from the war in 1918. Hitler missed probably the worst part of the German army's defeat in 1918 because he'd been blinded in a mustard gas attack, so he spent a lot of the time in a field hospital. So actually wasn't there for Germany's retreat and what would have been inevitable defeat. So he's convinced that politicians back in Germany have betrayed the German army and buys into this idea of the stab in the back myth. So when he comes back to Germany, he carries on working for the army as a spy, effectively, on the new political groups that are emerging. And he's reporting back to them about which ones are reliable and allies and which ones are a potential threat. So it's in this context that he attends a meeting of the German Workers' Party in a beer hall in Munich and is horrified by one of the speakers. So he spontaneously jumps onto the stage and gives a speech in which he denounces the left and talks about the greatness of Germany and how it needs to be restored. And at the end of his impromptu tirade, the leader of the party, Anton Drexler, approaches him and says, "You're exactly the man we need for our fledgling organisation. Would you sign up?" So Hitler goes back to the army and tells them that he has to resign from the army because he's joined one of the groups. And this launches his political career. And before that, I mean, there's nothing really of note in Hitler. He was the second lowest rank in the army because the officers didn't think he was a natural leader, which I always find incredible. And from then on, this is probably his first sort of proper job, other than being a soldier, because he was nothing really distinguished him at all before the war. He was a failed art student. So Hitler throws himself into the maelstrom of right-wing politics. There's a huge number of what we call Volkisch groups, in other words, sort of right-wing, racist, radical groups in Germany after the war. There's nothing particularly different about the Nazis. They're paramilitaries. They run around the streets fighting with communists who they don't like. But Hitler does show a flair for not just political oratory, but also for branding the party, in that he gives them the swastika, he gets the uniform, which is actually just bought Army X surplus stuff, and takes over the party from Drexler, which leads us up to the Munich Putsch, which I find hilarious. It's such a poorly conceived plan. It's like trying to overthrow Theresa May's government by starting a pub fight in Newcastle and expecting that to work. So Hitler does show talent in these early years, but there's nothing remarkable about the Nazis. And Hitler has an awful lot of lessons to learn about political power, and that's why I think the Munich Putsch is so raw and destined to failure.
As you've said, the Munich Putsch is an absolute shambles, and it totally fails its objectives. So why does the Nazi Party simply not disappear as a consequence of this failure and of the trial and imprisonment of Hitler? If either of you want to come in on that, that'd be great.
I suppose there's two factors. One is that Hitler learns from his mistakes in this instance, and the second one is to do with economic circumstances, so the Great Depression. So I suppose the first one we can point to is actually that Hitler doesn't give up after the Munich Putsch. He's given a very lenient jail sentence as a result of this. He's given 9 months. And interestingly, the reason he's given such a lenient sentence is actually because a lot of what he was doing and saying was popular with an ever-growing group of German people. The trial is remarkable. He uses it as an opportunity. He defends himself and basically turns it into a propaganda fest. It's covered by the whole of Germany's media, and he's able to disseminate his message much more widely. And again, the radio allows him to speak into people's homes, and his name is out there as Hitler, someone that people like the message of. He's very anti-Versailles, very anti, in particular, the war guilt clause and the economic sanctions put on Germany. And he sort of develops new ideas. He says that revolution isn't going to work. We have to use the Reichstag principle, this idea of getting in by voting. He says we're going to have to hold our noses and enter the Reichstag. He also comes up with this idea of the Führer principle as well, this idea of strong leadership, which at a time in which the Weimar government has no strong or viable leaders, again, he sort of presents himself as a figure who might be able to sort that out. So he continues to develop the party, spread it. He sets up Gaus, so he gets it not out of Munich this time. So he's going towards other areas in Germany, individual leadership on the ground. And then more coherent messages started to spread. His 25-point program has some stuff which is very popular. Talks about protecting pensions, talks about smashing the Treaty of Versailles. I mean, obviously, there's the seeds of his later sort of policies and say anti-Semitism, but again, you've got 25 points, and if 10 of them appeal to you, you're likely to vote for Hitler, same as you would do with any political organization now. So one aspect is that he learns from that lesson. The second thing, though, is that circumstances really do deal him a very favorable card. And it starts in 1929 in New York City in America, interestingly.
Can I just try for one moment? In terms of the Nazis in the mid-20s, you talk about this reorganization work that it is. Hitler does, but what benefits does it actually yield for the Nazis throughout most of the 20s? I mean, do they get an immediate electoral return from these changes?
They don't get anywhere with them straight away, but this is the boring stuff you need to do if you want to be a national political party. So as Matthew was saying, actually that expansion with the Gau and the Gauleiter system and actually developing their political message, really, really important work. And Hitler also establishes that strong leadership principle, as you mentioned earlier, at the Bamberg conference is a key moment, because this is a tough sell. He has to tell a group of mostly ex-soldiers who love violence and hate democracy that they now have to brush up their act and be Democrats and go knock on doors and ask people to vote for them. And the problem is, in the late 1920s, the economy's picked up quite a bit. American loans have certainly helped. This is the age of Stresemann and Germany's so-called golden era. So although nobody's willing to listen to the extremist message that Hitler's putting out there, the party infrastructure is built and Hitler's able to keep the show on the road, which is probably his biggest achievement. We don't see anything really in the way of a breakthrough, though, for the Nazis until they're able to campaign against the Young Plan in 1929 with Hugenberg, because Hitler gets exposure in Hugenberg's network of cinemas. So at least he reminds the public of who he is. And I think the interesting thing is, when the Wall Street cash kicks in, it's no guarantee who's going to pick up the votes after that. It's going to go to the most organised and effective parties. And all the work that Matthew described there means that Hitler's in a great position to capitalise if there's another crisis.
Matthew, you started to tell us about the impact of the Great Depression in Germany. Why is it so catastrophic in that country?
Well, it goes back to sort of a couple of things that Robin mentioned. So, as I say, it seems strange. Why does Germany go through a depression if it's something that happens in New York City? The Wall Street crash in 1929, the phrase America sneezes and the world catches a cold springs to mind. The issue is that the entirety of Europe post-World War I ends up reliant on the American economy remaining strong. What we get during the First World War is that the USA doesn't get involved until quite late on, and they then, but initially in the war, they're quite willing to loan the Allies money and resources and arms. So the Allies are tied to America directly through an economic link. The second thing that happens is that in 1926, we get the introduction of the Dawes Plan, in which we're able to, America is able to loan Germany money this time in order to help get its economy back on its feet, in order to help it start paying back those reparations which it owes to the Allies. What that creates, though, is this essential system, which means that if America is taken out of the equation, what's going to happen immediately is that the loans from the Allies are going to be recalled by America. The Allies are going to demand immediate reparations, and similarly, those loans which Germany was able to benefit in the Dawes Plan, and then the proposed Young Plan, is also going to fall. So the bottom is going to fall out of the European economy, because all roads lead back to America. So when the Wall Street crash hits, they call in the reparations, the Allies call in the reparations, and America calls in the loans from the Allies.
The Nazi Party benefits considerably from the economic crisis of the Great Depression, and votes are picked up in the early 30s. But that's not the only story of how the Nazis get into power. Yes, they do become the largest political party. Robin, can you tell us a little bit about the attitude of other politicians on the right? The historian Ian Kershaw talks about Hitler being levered into power. What do you think he meant by this?
I think some really important roles are played by leading Weimar figures. One is Chancellor Brüning, the Hunger Chancellor, who tries to steer the ship through 1930 to 32. His policies are all about austerity, so he increases taxes, he cuts spending. Very unpopular, and it ends up with the government having to get by using Article 48 of the Constitution, so emergency measures, because Brüning doesn't have enough support in the Reichstag. So when he goes, Hitler makes another sort of quantum leap forward in the summer 1932 election, where they jump up to 230 seats from 108, so it's a really big jump, and Hitler is now leader of the largest party. So he expects to be made chancellor at that point, and the curious thing is that the president, Hindenburg, who couldn't stand Hitler and referred to him as the Austrian corporal as a form of double insult, refuses to appoint him. And when he summons him to the Reichschancellery to explain that he won't be appointed, Hitler is furious and they have a very bitter personal fallout there. But instead, Hindenburg doesn't really have any other options. He opts for Franz von Papen, who is very much a yes man, best friends with his son, served with him in the army, an obscure diplomat who's a member of the Catholic Centre Party, but even the Catholic Centre Party don't like him. And the hope is that he will just do what he's told. Because he has no credibility, his government falls very quickly, and he's actually ousted by Hindenburg's key advisor, General Schleicher, who thinks that he's come up with a better plan. So he convinces Hindenburg to get rid of von Papen, and his plan is to try to split the Nazis by actually appealing to their left wing. Remember, they're the Nationalist Socialist German Workers' Party, so some of the members of the party are interested in those things that Matthew was talking about, the 25-point programme, like workers' rights and pensions, less so the racism side. So Schleicher thinks that if he can win over the left wing of the party by appointing its lead figure, a guy called Gregor Strasser, in his cabinet, then he might split the Nazis and take things in a new direction. This completely fails. Hitler steps in. He denounces Strasser. Strasser resigns from the party. Schleicher is now sort of dead in the water. So this is the key moment, because actually Hitler has lost votes in the last election of 1932, and he's also run out of money. So at this moment, he needs a break, and he gets it from von Papen, yesterday's man who looks like he's gone from politics. Von Papen's very bitter at the way that Schleicher manoeuvred him out of office. So he goes to Hindenburg with a proposal. Appoint Hitler in a cabinet that's packed with conservatives. I'll be his vice chancellor. And then one of two things will happen. Either Hitler will succeed, in which case, great, we'll take the credit. Or he'll fail miserably, in which case we can dismiss him and no more problem with the Nazis. It's a win-win situation. Hindenburg buys it. Hitler is made chancellor.
But the prospect for a strong and stable government here does not look very promising. Hitler is only one of three Nazis in the cabinet. He has been levered into power by a group of politicians who only want to use him temporarily. And yet, how did he surprise his enemies and rivals in his first few months in power?
Well, you can either say that he got lucky or Hitler made his own luck, probably the latter. We have a remarkable event. You say his hands are tied, he's meant to be in a minority government, he's got no Nazis around him, what can he do? Well, mysteriously, or not mysteriously, the Reichstag building, the parliament building, is burnt down in a fire. The man who is caught and fingered for this is a guy called Marius van der Lubbe, who is a communist. And what Hitler is able to do with this scenario is then parade this communist and say, look how unstable, look how dangerous German society is. Look what we're dealing with, particularly with the communists, who are his main rivals, suppose politically, Germany could go left or right. And he's then able to take that clause in the constitution, which Robin mentioned earlier, Article 48, which essentially allows the chancellor to rule by veto. So he doesn't need to consult parliament, doesn't need to consult that very, very conservative pact council he has around him. So he's able to rule essentially by diktat, as a dictator, essentially, but at this point. And he uses this Reichstag fire. I say, was it he got lucky or would he make his own luck? The suggestion very much is that this was a Nazi burning down of the building, and they managed to find and frame this communist for the attack.
And what does he do to the communists in the first few months of his rule?
Well, immediately just banning of the communist parties, and that starts a systematic approach to sort of get rid of opposition. So initially to ban those parties, to arrest them, and start to use the apparatus of his sort of his terror tactics, I suppose. We're going to talk about the creation of the Gestapo. He's created an organisation called the SS, which was, who are going to supersede the SA, who he's had before. Another thing which finally allows him to become dictator rather than simply chancellor ruling by veto is, the fortunate death of Hindenburg. Hitler views this as an opportunity to, again, in the Reichstag constitution, there's a president and there's a chancellor. What he's able to do at that point is to take away the role of president and unite chancellor and president into one role, which he calls the Reichsführer. And at that point, Hitler is officially dictator with complete control over all of German politics.
We've just heard how Hitler bans and arrests the communists. But Robin, earlier you mentioned Gregor Strasser and Hitler's critics from within the Nazi movement. How did he turn against them in the second year of his rule?
This is a really interesting step in Hitler's consolidation of power, because in 1933, having managed to ban all other political parties and passing the Enabling Act, you would think that Hitler would be fairly secure. But actually, the rank and file of the Nazi Party want an awful lot more. They want immediate action against the Jews. They want immediate action against the Treaty of Versailles. So Hitler recognises that things have to be done in stages and that he has to present a friendly face to the outside world because he's still in a very weak position internationally. So if there's any fear that he actually might be taking Germany down a warlike path, then there could be a reaction against him. He could be unseated from abroad. So what Hitler does is shuts down all political opposition in 1933, shuts down the trade unions. He opens concentration camps so that any political opposition to the regime will go there. But these are not death camps yet, so they are just another sort of aspect of prison, but especially for political prisoners. And as far as the party rank and file are concerned, this is not enough. So one of the things that he does accept is a one-day boycott of Jewish shops, which is organised by the SA, but that's the only action against the Jews. And you know, ordinary German racists in the Nazi Party think, why on earth are we not doing something more about this? So into 1934, the main critic is the head of the SA, Ernst Röhm, who is openly speaking his mind about the fact that Hitler hasn't done enough, that the promised revolution has been a bit underwhelming, has been violent enough for the SA's liking. And Röhm's an interesting guy. He's one of the old members of the Nazi Party. He's the only one who gets to call Hitler Adolf and talks about him in very derogatory terms. And he's despised in the rest of the party. And the man who hates him most is Himmler, the head of the SS, the smaller organisation, the baby brother organisation. So Himmler feeds lots of information to Hitler, tries to convince him that Röhm is going to overthrow Hitler. And that's a serious threat. You have to keep in mind that the SA at this point are numbering something like 2.5 million men. They're far, far bigger than the army. So if Röhm decides to mobilise them, then we've got an interesting power struggle. Hitler is furious about this and organises a strike. So the Night of the Long Knives involves around about 100-odd of the Nazis' leading enemies internally being arrested by the SS and executed. So Ernst Röhm goes, but they settle some old scores as well. Gregor Strasser goes. We also get General Schleicher as well goes. And actually one or two people who had nothing to do with it, who were just unfortunately had the same name as the targets that the Nazis were going after. So it's a one-night bloodbath that is considered to be legal because the Führer says it is so. And so what we have now is legalised murder in the Nazi state.
You've just demonstrated to us the ultra-loyalty of the SS and their willingness to carry out violence. And one of the most infamous features of the Nazi state is Hitler's control of various secret police organisations. Does that mean that there were secret policemen on every corner? Was every letter being steamed open? Was every telegram being intercepted? And how did the secret police get their information? Matthew, can you tell us about that?
I suppose the short answer to that one is no, to debunk a myth. It's not the case that this is a... Were the Gestapo operating? Yes. Were they terrifying? Yes. But the way in which it operated is very much an interesting debate. One about cooperation and coercion is one that often comes up in terms of Nazi Germany. The Gestapo as a body of officers, not enormous, but what they do have is an enormous network of informers. What it relies on in Nazi Germany is basically dobbing your neighbours, your parents, friends, family in. So you were encouraged in all areas of your life to root out and pass on information if you heard anyone talking about the Nazi Party or in particular Hitler in a derogatory or inflammatory way. Organisations like the Hitler Youth and the League of German Maidens encouraged their members, young people, to spy on their parents. Anything that was anti-Hitler, a joke about them, was to be passed on. And that's how the Gestapo got their information. Similarly, if you were in a neighbourhood and you saw one of your neighbours cavorting with maybe members of the Jewish community, or again, you had heard that at a dinner party, someone had made a joke about the Führer, that information was passed on. So the Gestapo themselves, not a massive organisation in terms of it's not those agents that are going out and spying on people, but they rely very much on the cooperation of ordinary German people.
So clearly Hitler is wanting to build some kind of society that's based on support from German people. Let's move on to look at the kind of society that Hitler was wanting. Historians often use the word Volksgemeinschaft or racial community. If we were to look at the experience of women and young people in Nazi Germany, how could we understand the idea of the racial community, Robin?
This is a really interesting point because the Nazis are such a contradictory group in what they think and what they organise. So in some ways, they're very forward looking in that they're great with propaganda. They embrace the radio and the cinema and their mass messaging is outstanding. But on the other hand, they're so backward looking in Hitler's love of architecture that's very classical in style and that women should be as they were in the 19th century. When Hitler talks about the Volksgemeinschaft, this idea of a national community, I think it's doubtful that it ever actually takes off. Most Germans are quite happy if they have a job and a decent standard of living and more security than they had in the 1920s. So lots of them turn a blind eye to the parts of the regime that they don't particularly like, be it the concentration camps or anti-Jewish activity. So what most Germans appreciate about the 1930s is that Hitler solves the problem of unemployment. It's more through luck than judgment, I think. The economy had actually hit rock bottom in late 1932 and was on the way back up anyway, just before Hitler came to power. But it helps that he does actually rebuild the military, which he's not allowed to do, of course, under the Treaty of Versailles. But this is a time of worldwide economic depression, so no other nation steps in when Hitler decides to expand the army by 400,000 men in 1935 or build a Luftwaffe. So these things create jobs. We should also keep in mind that Hitler is only in power for 6 years before the Second World War starts out, so there's a huge amount of state spending that wouldn't have been sustainable in the long term. It would have led to more inflation and probably bankruptcy at some point. But Hitler also benefits from other things like the return of the Tsarland in 1935. It's returned to him through a mechanism of the Treaty of Versailles. Germany gets back its richest industrial coal mining area, and that's another shot in the arm to the economy. So what we see is an overall picture where the economy has recovered. Lots of programmes are being aimed at the workers to try and get them to be more loyal to the Nazis. The workers don't really develop any great love of the Nazi party, but they do like the fact that they have a job. As far as women go, well, actually, they're the big losers in this. They're not encouraged to have jobs. They're not encouraged to go to university. The great catchphrase that everyone remembers is Kinderküche Kirche. So women are meant to stay at home, have children, cook, and if they're allowed out, it's to go to church. So this is a really male-orientated society in which a high level of employment allows Hitler to get away with it.
And the Nazis claim to be building a society for the long term. Matthew, could you tell us a little bit about their attitudes to young people and the role that young people were supposed to play?
Yep. So Hitler's very, very clear about this. Essentially, he says at one point, your children are mine already. What he's talking about here is long levity. He wants to build a 1,000-year Reich that's going to last for well beyond Hitler's own lifetime. What he sees is it's important to indoctrinate people and indoctrinate them young so they know nothing else. One of the ways in which he does this initially is through setting up youth movements. So we get something called the Hitler Youth created, which are for boys, and the League of German Maidens for girls. And again, this sort of idea that men and women are in separate spheres and have separate roles to play is reinforced in these clubs. Boys are allowed to do outdoor activities, sport. They're meant to do marching, very much military preparation sort of stuff. Whereas girls are given lessons in embroidery, sewing, cooking, cleaning, childbearing. So again, these sort of two gendered roles are reinforced in those organisations. Once the Nazis are in power, this continues in the school curriculum. Again, girls are taught biology, specifically again about sort of child rearing, and the boys are taught much more physical skills, taught about soldiering. This also plays out, I suppose, in when the youth organisations get more influential is when he bans all sports clubs. So basically all alternatives to Hitler Youth or League of German Maidens are taken out. So all young people in Germany are supposed to be members of these organisations. Now that isn't to say there's opposition. There's things you could point to like the Swing Kids, or you could talk about the Edelweiss Pirates. So not all young people buy into this. There is opposition to it. But the idea very much is to indoctrinate young people as early as possible in the roles that Hitler wants them to play in his 1,000-year Reich.
Matthew, a moment ago you mentioned a couple of groups who didn't fit in with this vision of the racial community. Robin, can you tell us a little bit about who were the outside groups in the Nazi state and what was their fate?
Hitler and his cronies believe in a really obscure bit of science that has since been massively debunked. So they're into social Darwinism and they believe in racial superiority. It's based on some really nonsense historiography from the late 19th century and early 20th century that emphasises that some races are better than others. So they believe that the Aryan race, in other words, Northern Europeans, are superior to other races around the world. So it essentially means anyone who's non-European would fall into this category of being sort of subhuman, but in particular the Jews. And this taps into a very long-standing history of anti-Semitism, not just in Germany, but across Europe. And Hitler grows up with this as a very heavy influence on him. There's a banking crash in Vienna in the 1870s that sparks a wave of modern anti-Semitism that Hitler grew up being surrounded by. So many others tap into this. So you would identify the Jews as the main group that are persecuted in Nazi society. And that becomes very open from 1938 onwards. When Hitler takes over Austria in the Anschluss of 1938, in the spring of 1938, we see the first kind of open mass violence against Jews. Jews have already been restricted in the 1935 Nuremberg laws about what they can and can't do and the fact they're not considered German citizens. But in late 1938, we have the Reichskristallnacht, in which mass violence organised and carried out by the SS, but in plain clothes to make it look like it was a spontaneous uprising, takes place, and large numbers of Jews are killed, synagogues are destroyed, and Jews are blamed for this violence. And it all stems from an incident where a young Jewish man shot and killed a German official in the embassy in Paris in protest about how his mother had been treated by Hitler's government. So very much the Jews are the source of most Nazi venom, but by no means the only group. We do get religious minorities who suffered other than Jews in this period. We see that there are small groups, as Matthew mentioned, of youth organisations that hold out against the Nazis. But there's just not enough of a groundswell of opposition to actually stand up for other groups.
To continue with Nazi persecution of the Jews, how did the outbreak of war, but especially the extension of the war into the East in 1941, impact on the accelerating persecution of Jews?
I suppose it's interesting. Anti-Semitism is one of the core principles of Hitler's ideology. It's there in Mein Kampf, which he writes in 1923, and it's there in the 25-point programme. So this is not new. And it's remarkable when you consider how anti-Semitic he is, when you consider how few Jews there are in Germany. It's less than 1% of the population. We're talking less than 400,000 people in Germany are Jewish. And he makes out to be this massive problem. There is a conspiracy of world Jewry to undermine the German nation. So we talk about this small statistic. Why does it get worse in World War II? Well, quite simply because more Jews appear under Hitler's radar. When we invade Poland, and particularly when we push east into Russia, for example, Russia alone has 8 million Jews, or estimated 8 million Jewish people in its community. And so the Jewish problem, as Hitler styles it, gets bigger, largely in terms of numbers. So we move from a situation where we've got a minority who we've made a scapegoat of less than 400,000 people to a large number. They estimate sort of, I imagine, 12 million Jews, I think, on the whole of the eastern region which they take over.
What happens to those Jewish populations in Russia and the Baltic states when the Germans arrive?
Initially, there's two things going on. So initially we could talk about the creation of ghettos. So for example, when they arrive in Poland, they decide to segregate it. So the ghetto in Warsaw, it houses 400,000 alone. Then we can talk about Einsatzgruppen. The German army, as they push east, it's interesting. They've got a fighting force who are taking on the armies of Russia. But there's a second group, and this is particularly sinister. We've got a group called the Einsatzgruppen action groups who are just going in to hunt down and murder Jews in their homes. Now, the problem that develops with this is, again, to do with numbers and slightly to do with morale, which is less of a convincing argument. Basically, it's very, very manpower heavy to go out and try and find these individuals and shoot them. And similarly, the German army, poor them, are getting very demoralised by this process of having to go and murder people in cold blood. And so what we get to is a sort of crisis point in terms of this idea of the Jewish problem, which is then discussed at the Vanti Conference of 1942. This conference has got a lot of attention. It's where the decision is made to implement the final solution. Now, I say it's where the decision is made. There's a lot of historiographical debate as to whether it was already made before this, and this is simply to rubber stamp it. I mean, when you look at the other stuff they discuss at the Vanti Conference, shall we ship them all to Madagascar? You can sort of see that...
Which is the key group coordinating that conference? Who's really in charge of that meeting?
Basically, the SS. We're talking about Himmler and we're talking about Heydrich. Those two individuals sort of orchestrate it. Again, you could get into a debate as to Hitler's personal involvement in this, the relationship between it, the lack of a paper trail, etc. But that really is the SS who drive this, and it's the SS Death's Head Brigades which run these camps which are set up all across, particularly Eastern Europe. They like to keep it out of Germany. There are some camps in Germany themselves. Largely these are labour camps. You have to draw a distinction in a labour camp and a concentration camp, although lots of them move from one to the other. But a lot of them are in Eastern Europe, in Poland, thinking particularly of Auschwitz being the major centre of Jewish killing, which results ultimately in the murder of 6 million Jews. And again, as Rob mentioned, we've got other groups, so we've got them that are affected by the Holocaust.
And how do the? I mean, this is possibly the worst and darkest phase of world history. What? How do the methodologies and scale of numbers being killed change from 1942 onwards?
Well, from 1942 onwards, the whole machinery of the Nazi state is geared towards a total war, which is also, I think, a big contributing factor, because in 1939, when war begins by invading Poland, and in 1940, the war with France and Britain, Hitler's policies to try to keep things in the home front as normal as possible, so that the fighting is going to be done abroad, but everyone else, there's going to be no change in tax levels or in jobs. You know, everyone's going to carry on. This is going to be nice and straightforward. That clearly has changed in 1941 with the invasion of the Soviet Union and with the Germans getting bogged down in places like Stalingrad into 1942-43. So the Wannsee Conference aims to try to solve the Jewish problem of freedom, manpower as well, for fighting the Russians in the Eastern Front. So that's why these death camps are created. That's why the ghettos are liquidated. And we end up with a phase from 1942 through to 1944 where these are highly operational with large staff. And the capacity for killing at Auschwitz is something like 10,000 people a day.
What method are these entirely innocent civilians being murdered by the Nazis?
I mean, this is tragic. And Matthew referred early on to the problem of actually going around and trying to kill 11, 12 million people as was the target by putting a bullet in their head. So instead, they try to devise a process that will speed things up. So what they do is they establish a system where people come into a concentration camp like an Auschwitz or a Treblinka. They are convinced that they're going for a shower, so they leave behind all their belongings and they go into a room which is actually filled up with poison gas. And the gas itself was originally used as a rat poison. And they discovered that actually this would be a very effective way of killing people. So tins of this stuff, it looks like a tin of baked beans, really. It's just opened and thrown in a hatch at the top. They shut all the doors. They wait until everyone's dead. And then the other side of this fake shower room, you have a furnace where people are, the bodies are thrown in. They're incinerated and the next group gets brought in. It's hideous. There's a model of how this works in the Imperial War Museum in London, and you can see it. And it's just like a conveyor belt of death. It is hideous.
So by 1942, we're in the nightmare of the Holocaust and the existence of camps such as Auschwitz, Treblinka and many other sites of mass murder. Let's move to look at the impact of that war on Germany itself. I wonder whether the German people ever expected that they would be at war with Britain, Russia and America, whether they ever expected that they'd be fighting a war on land, sea and air. How did this change the lives of the German people back home, Matthew?
Interestingly, actually, I suppose in the early phases of the war, largely because Hitler was aggressive and he's invading other countries, life gets better for a lot of Germans, actually. The diet improves. The more resources are coming into Russia, so into Germany. The occupied places, they're able to send back food and other supplies. So life initially does pick up. But as I mentioned, when total war kicks in, particularly when we start to get the pushback by the Allies, so sort of from 1941, 42 onwards, things start to get particularly bleak. You get the introduction of rationing, deeply, deeply unpopular. The economy starts to collapse around them, particularly as the manpower problem of fighting a war. So the German army, as troops get decimated, we have to find people to fill those positions, take men out of factories who are making munitions and producing stuff for the home front. That then creates a crisis in production back in Germany. Again, largely due to Hitler's ideology on the roles of women. He is very reluctant to do as in Britain, as in America, allow women to go into factories to produce stuff during the Second World War. That decision is not taken until 1942. By that point, arguably, it's too late for that to make any impact. And things start to get from bad to worse. Particularly then we get the Allied bombing of German cities. We could talk about Hamburg, we could talk about Dresden. Incendiary bombs are dropped on these German cities. We talk about the Blitz and sort of often forget that it also happened to German civilians.
What measures did the Nazi government take to try and keep the German economy in the war? You've described a devastating attacks against the German industrial economy. How on earth did they keep fighting through to 1944-45?
The big shift that comes really midway through the war, when we see it's broadcast widely to the German public by Goebbels in 1943, this infamous speech he gives that announces that they are at total war. Suddenly everything changes. People are put into war-related industries. Rationing comes in. A black market opens up again, just as it did during the First World War. And huge amounts of propaganda are wheeled out to try to convince people that this is a fight to the death with communism and for world dominance. So everybody's lives changes and suddenly goes back to the way it had really been during the First World War, I would say. The other key individual here is Albert Speer. So he is Hitler's personal architect, but a very able organiser. And one of the big problems that the Germans have industrially is that They are producing some excellent high-end equipment, you know, very fine detail in everything that they do, and it all works very well. But it's complicated, it's slow to produce, it's difficult to repair, parts are tough to manufacture.
Robin, could you give us an example of some of these so-called miracle weapons that were meant to completely turn around the war in the last months?
Listen, I mean, the V2 rocket's the classic one, and it's interesting that German missile technology is then used in the Cold War in the arms race, and one of Stalin's main projects in 1945 is to try to get to Berlin before the Allies, because he wants to get his hands on German scientific data that's been produced that talks about how these missiles are actually going to fly. So the ICBMs that come around later owe their existence to the V2 rockets. Enormous tanks. The Germans have got the biggest, most powerful tanks, but they just don't have as many of them as the Russians have. Stalin is able to outproduce the Nazis, so that the Nazis can't shoot down Russian planes as quickly as Stalin can build them, and that's the single biggest problem. Speer is able to turn things around, and he increases German productivity by streamlining it and making the products more basic. But the German army doesn't particularly like that. But by this time, I think I'd agree with Matthew. I think the war is probably already in a losing position by sort of 1942 anyway for the Nazis.
So if the war is already in a losing position, why didn't more Germans rise up and try and remove this government from power? As Robin has said, the mathematics don't add up from 1942 onwards for a German victory.
First of all, you have to understand that some people did try and rise up to try and stop this from happening and try and oppose Hitler and the Nazis. Talked earlier about some of the youth group examples. So he talks about the Edelweiss Pirates, the Swing Kids. Again, sort of very local sort of skirmishes with Hitler youth. Not going to have a massive impact, but opposition is there. We can look at the church. We look at people like Bonhoeffer. We can look at like Niemöller. Very, very successful initially in getting something like the T4 euthanasia program stopped. The Nazis actually have to stop killing those who are disabled because of that policy. Although again, that opposition is eventually silenced. Probably the most famous example though, recently turned into a film starring Tom Cruise, is the bomb plot, the Stauffenberg bomb plot. This is probably the largest, and the numbers involved in this really show how angry and how dissatisfied Germans, and these are patriotic Germans as well, who had become with Hitler and his regime. Basically, the plan was to blow up Hitler at a meeting of army officials. The bomb was put in a briefcase carried by Colonel Stauffenberg. Again, largely due to luck, the briefcase is moved. The blast does destroy the room, but Hitler himself remains intact. If he had have died, a very, very different outcome to World War II.
You mentioned luck a moment ago, and of course that wasn't the only attempt on Hitler's life. It seems that he had extraordinarily high levels of luck given these repeated assassination attempts. Do we know what the levels of popularity of Hitler were during wartime?
I think it's very difficult to say because we're not really conducting opinion polls at this time that were in any way accurate. But I think if anything, the stability of the regime probably comes from the impact of the bombing campaign that Matthew talked about earlier on. It had been designed to weaken German morale and bomber command, and the American planes are dropping bombs on cities as well as in industrial regions. And instead, it has the opposite effect. An awful lot of Germans increase their hatred for the Allies. So they're not necessarily fighting for Hitler, but against the enemy. And the interesting thing that takes place as well in sort of late 1944 into 1945, you know, as the regime is crumbling, some Germans hang doggedly on to the end of it. And Ian Kershaw has written very well about this in his book The End, in which the opening example is of a student who realises that in the small town he lives in, it's about to be blown to bits by the Americans. So he gets word out to them to try to stop them from doing this. He's discovered and is publicly hanged in the centre of the town. And the next day, the Americans come in anyway. The amazing thing about this example is that it comes a week after Hitler committed suicide, and everybody knew that. So some Germans remained fanatically committed to the end. But also in the centre of Berlin, the last people who are actually fighting for the Nazis are the Hitler Youth and the French fascists. Many others have given up on the cause by then.
You mentioned that the last days of the Reich. So by the winter of 1944, the spring of 1945, all of those conquests have been lost. Germany is being devastated from the air, and Hitler returns to Berlin to lead a largely underground existence in his very last few days. Hitler had been obsessed with how the war had ended in November 1918. He talked about betrayal and a stab in the back, and he said that this would never happen again under his rule. Could either of you talk me just through the very last days of the Third Reich and how it finally does come to an end?
It's all a bit pathetic, really, I suppose. They end up in an underground bunker, sort of Hitler's last post of defence, him and his closest advisors. He's there also with Eva Braun, Goring, Goebbels, they're all there. people talk about how Hitler was very much in denial. He's still, until very, very late, moving divisions of troops that don't exist anymore on the Eastern Front and on the Western Front. He still thinks this war is winnable. He still thinks it's achievable. Albert Speer is still drawing up plans for the new Berlin, so these brand new buildings. So there's a degree of sort of denial and sort of fantasism going on within Hitler's own psyche. But when the end does... It is no longer deniable. He can no longer bury his head in the sand. He takes a course of action, which is he does not want to fall into the hands of the Russians. The Russians are the ones who are going to win this race to Berlin, and he refuses to do that. So Hitler takes his own life by shooting himself, not before also Eva Braun committing suicide. I believe he shoots his dog as well, so he doesn't get taken. And similar things happen. The Goebbels family poison their own children before, again, taking their own lives. So in this bunker, the henchmen, the closest, the top Nazis all end up committing suicide just because they don't want to get captured. Imagine the humiliation and the treatment of them afterwards. They wanted to avoid that fate.
I think that's a really important point, because there's this awful myth about Hitler escaped and went to Latin America. And it's complete nonsense, and it's propagated by people who don't understand the end of the war. So two things Hitler greatly feared, as Matthew mentioned, being caught by the Russians. Being caught by Stalin was the worst possible thing imaginable. And Hitler also really felt he was let down by the German people. He wanted total destruction at the end. And he was actually ordering offensives that would have led to the destruction of Berlin and everything within it, because he wants to take down Germany with him. But the other thing he's aware of is what happened to Mussolini. When Mussolini is caught, he's killed, but his body is publicly displayed. It's hung on a hook in a square, I think, in Rome, where people can line up and spit on him. Hitler does not want this to happen to him, so he draws up his last will and testament, and he commits suicide. He also knows that he's been betrayed by some of his key allies. He discovers that Himmler has been negotiating with the Americans. That causes him to completely lose it.
And yet he blames the German people, doesn't he, Robin, for letting him down?
It's the German people who let him down, apparently, yes. And Albert Speer has also said his goodbyes by the very end as well. So Matthew says there's this moment where Hitler suddenly realises that, yes, the game is up. And actually probably the most impressive move of the tail end of the war, which is very well detailed in Anthony Beaver's book on Berlin, is actually how the German generals ignored Hitler's orders and created a sort of cordon sanitaire to allow refugees to get out of the way of the oncoming Soviet army, an army which, after everything that the Nazis had done to them, was hell-bent on revenge. And Beaver estimates that at least 1 million women were raped by the Soviet army coming in through Eastern Europe. So the German army performs a manoeuvre that allows civilians to get out of the way of the Red Army before they reach Berlin. And by the time they do, Hitler is very definitely dead.
So we have a devastating end to the war with Europe. We have millions of casualties, both civilian and military. We have the worst genocide in history. And clearly a governing and ruling system which there was no positive legacy, only misery and suffering. Robin McPherson, Matthew Patti, thank you very much for talking today about Germany 1918 to 1945.
Thank you.
Thank you.